There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Now, exam season's upon us, with stressed students, worried parents trying to keep it all together. But how can we keep teenagers calm? How much anxiety is normal? And what can we do to motivate those young people who just don't seem to care at all? To guide us through this topic, and most importantly, to answer your questions and address your concerns, I'm joined by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor, Human Relations Institute and Clinic, and parenting coach Sue Atkins, as the parenting expert on ITV's This Morning, BBC Radio, Sky News and Good Morning Britain. She's helped thousands of parents navigate the tricky world of raising kids from babies to teens, and she's a mum of two herself. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Sue and Chastity.
Good afternoon. Lovely to be here.
It's lovely to have a studio full of experts here, and I might be asking some questions off air to get my own weekly dose of therapy. Welcome to Dubai, Sue. How long are you here for?
Wonderful. I go home on Friday night at sort of 2 a.m. and get back home on Saturday. It's a brief trip, but I really want to come back. I love it.
It's your first time to Dubai?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Never and been enjoying
it? Oh, loving it. The people are wonderful. The whole thing is fascinating. So I'm having a great time.
And you've come over to talk about your new parenting club and yes. Webinars that you're doing.
Yes, I do a monthly e-course, a monthly webinar. I do weekly podcasts, all for my members, and all my exclusive content around parenting from babies to teens.
So why did you get into becoming a parenting coach? Because I can imagine yes. It's probably not a very easy job.
Very well, I love it, of course. Well, I was a deputy head and class teacher for 25 years.
This is the perfect topic for you then Mrs. Atkins, yes. As you were previously
yes.
known.
That's right, you're so right. And I must have had a midlife crisis. No, actually, my father died and my mother died within the same year of each other.
Oh,
and I actually thought, do I want to teach the Vikings for another 25 years? And
was
I
the thought, answer no?
Yes, no. And I got so interested in self-esteem for children and the gift of self-esteem. Who gives it to you initially? Your parents. So then I worked backwards from there. And then I was invited to write my first book called Raising Happy Children for Dummies, one in the famous black and yellow. And then a few years later, was invited by Penguin to write another book. And I've written about 21 different books and e-courses all around parenting.
Wow.
Passionate about parenting.
Very.
Yeah.
It sounds like you need to drink a lot of coffee, Sue, because that's a very busy, packed life.
Yeah, well, I enjoy it, you see. When you do something that you love, it's not like work. I can't separate them. I'm supposed to be on holiday.
And here you are talking to us. Do you find yourself stopping people in the street saying, oh, just while we're having this conversation, have you got any questions for me? Do you ever switch off?
I have a Don't Stew, Ask Sue, where people can ask me on my podcast whatever problems you've got on
well,
niggles.
Well, this is also your chance to have your questions answered by the experts this afternoon live on air. How's your week been, Chastity? What's going on?
It's been really good. I'm excited. We're doing our research studies at the American University in
yes.
Sharjah.
Tell me, this is based around social media use.
Yes, it is. It's looking at the connection between social media usage. In particular, we're focusing on FOMO, or fear of missing out, and its relationship with psychological distress, psychological well-being, and certainly looking at depressive symptomology, anxiety. So we're in week 3 of the intervention. So we're actually conducting an experiment at the university. Lots of great university participants.
Are you looking at me when you said the word intervention there, Chastity?
I maybe my body language was betraying me, but I would love if you wanted to dabble in it as well. We're looking to expand to adults as well.
Well, so it's really interesting timing, actually, because in honesty, I adore Instagram, and the lines are quite blurred with me because I have a parenting blog and you know whatnot. And over the last week, I've just been feeling a bit about it. I've just it's been complete overuse, I think, and I've just kind of made a decision to take a bit of a step away from it. And that's not to say I'm not going to be using it, because I adore it as a medium. I really do. I love the aesthetics of nice photos. I've discovered so many great people and bought fantastic
yes.
dresses and found
yeah.
books and music and events and things around town through Instagram.
Yes.
But I think for my own kind of personal, that I wasn't getting as much balance. So I'm taking yes. a bit of a step back over
well,
the next
couple
of weeks.
Well, I call that a pause to ponder, because we all get that. And I've had that too, where you know you're in bed, it's about 11 o'clock and something pops up. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, I'll just reply to that.
And then you're down the rabbit hole.
And then it's half one in the morning and you think, actually I need to turn off. And then you can't sleep because, of course, the blue lights and all that keep you buzzed up.
Exactly.
So if we're like that as parents and older people, what are young children going to be
and
like?
And as kind of more sophisticated consumers of media who know perhaps what tricks, you know, the games or apps are using to kind of keep you engaged and keep you potentially spending
going to
money.
And also going up to the next level. That's the addiction side of it, isn't it? For kids. Oh, let's just get to the next level. I can't have dinner. I can't come down yet. Just got to finish off. That's the whole thing that kids don't know and don't think about. And we need to protect our kids from some of this, don't we?
And you know, I've just had a bit of a reality check where I've seen my one-year-old taking my phone off me and, you know, holding up and pretending that she's talking on the phone, thinking, okay, this is...
But there's another thing, there's been a survey recently where children starting school haven't really been engaged in real books and start doing that with books at school.
So trying to swipe a page.
Yes. Yeah, oh, yes, it's radio.
Just had to explain for everybody what you were doing with your hands.
And I just continue nodding, going, yeah.
So I think we need to talk about that, you know, as parents and stuff.
But in terms of modelling behaviour and also being present with my kids. And believe me, I am no shining example of, you know, what to do and what not to do with social media and children, but I just felt like it's better for me just to put it in the bedroom when I get home and then be with the kids.
And do you notice a difference?
Well, it's only been day two.
Oh, okay.
but
come back next week.
But what is interesting is, you know, because I was... And I got a bit like this with Facebook when it first launched as well. You know, for the Facebook status updates were things like, Helen is.
Yes.
And I would find myself throughout the day completely subconsciously thinking of updates or, you know, my brain would go to that place. And I've got the same way with Instagram in terms of thinking and captions, in Instagram stories. I'm like, no, just be here.
It's like living your life as if it's a sort of a public interest thing.
Yes.
And I think kids would find that they get significance from that. That's where there's a lot of problems with bullying and people pretending to have this wonderful life. And back to the topic that we'll be talking about, the anxiety, the stress. It used to be, you know, having a wonderful time. Oh, therefore I'm not doing all
that
these lovely
constant
things.
Constant comparisons.
And young people are, you know, impressionable. They don't understand the bigger picture and they judge themselves to be not having a wonderful time. Therefore they feel failures or something.
I have started unfollowing a few people that do not make me feel good about my life. Generally people who look amazing all the time despite having...
It's not even real, is it?
No, of course it's not. And I know that, but on some level it still kind of manages to creep into that subconscious and niggle, doesn't it?
But it's interesting because in England there's a guy, they're called Ant and Dec, and they're hugely famous.
Well, I'm from the northeast, so
so you get it.
I've met them a few times.
Look at you.
It's a village, the northeast.
But we talked a lot about Ant, and then I used the example for parents because they suddenly, you know, Saturday Night Takeaway was pulled, and I wanted to use that opportunity with parents to talk and teach. I talk a lot about can you be that happy all the time in real life? So use the experience that he's going through to talk and teach your
children.
And
for those who don't know, he's just been arrested and is going through a kind of quite a public ordeal because he was drink driving and he's had quite the kind of fall from grace and is very, very remorseful and has been fined a huge amount of money. But it did go to show that there's this big public veneer and a lot more going on behind the scenes.
Yes,
speaking of which, we must give our congratulations in terms of parenting news to the Duchess of Cambridge on the birth of her third child, another baby boy. No name yet. Any predictions, Chastity?
I didn't really think about it till you just asked me. And now Edward came to mind, maybe.
Baby Eddie.
I like Bertie.
Yeah, baby Bertie.
I've got a cat called Bertie, so that doesn't mean anything.
Well, she'd just be copying you then.
Right, absolutely.
But I really felt for her. You know, she gives birth. 7 hours later, she's there on the steps of the Lindo wing, blow dried to perfection, makeup done.
I know.
You know, looking absolutely impeccable. And let's not have any illusions here. There is, I'm sure, a team of people there, an outfit been no doubt planned for months, and you know, she's wearing the Queen's earrings, and it's all very choreographed.
Managed.
Yeah,
yes,
of course it is, and you know, that's completely understandable. But as a mum, I just really felt for her, and I know not to say it gets easier the more children you have in terms of recovery after birth, but it can be easier for some women, and you are keen to get home if you are feeling that bit more capable and confident after your second, third, fourth child. But 7 hours after giving birth, I think I was just, you know, weeping, you know, quietly in a corner somewhere.
I was asking if I could like check in for another few days as if I were at a hotel. I'm like, can we extend the stay? Because it is, you know, it's a big change. And and especially when women are having children, much more in isolation without the support of community and family, or as much support of community and family. Having just that someone preparing your meals for you in the hospital, something just as simple as that.
Or that, I remember that the kind of the little bell you could ring, because in Dubai everything's on private health insurance. So my I had an amazing experience as giving birth in Dubai. I really, really did, because the nurses were incredible, and I didn't really want to go home either. But I'm pretty sure Kate will have a few nurses at home to help her out as
well. Well, the thing is, I've just written an e-course actually going from two to three children, because there is a step up. We were just talking about it off air, because there is that thing. And I talk about perhaps could your other children go to grandma if you haven't got the facilities of nannies and things. Go to grandma maybe for a day or two so that you can bond and your partner can bond with the baby without all the other children.
Because with the first one, you really don't have any distractions. No. It's you, your partner, and the baby, and everyone talks about this baby bubble being for the first few days, and it very much is. And I remember leaving the hospital and thinking, wow, life has gone on around me. People have gone to work, and people are, you know, flying up and driving and, you know, having conversations, and I've been in this lovely little warm cocoon of me and baby and trying to bond. But when it came to my second, I was aware of I must get home to help with
the
other one.
Yeah, and the thing is, mums always want to be super mum, and that really puts enormous pressure on you. There is no such thing as a super mum unless you sort of, I don't know, Julia Roberts in a film or something.
It's a fictional super mum.
It is, and I think you have to be mindful of that, because you want to be the best mum you can be, or dad. You want to be a super parent, but actually you have to take good care of yourself too, because it's that oxygen thing. It's like the mask needs to come down and you take care of yourself first, not because you're selfish, but then you can take care of the children. So I think that super mum mentality and getting back too soon to work or back too soon to anything, just take your time, bond and enjoy those special moments.
Our advice to you, Kate Middleton, Duchess of Cambridge. Do stay with us when we come back. We're talking about, do you get happier in your marriage the longer you are married, or is the honeymoon phase really the place to be? Also asking, when you're born in the academic year, how much does that affect your success in later life? Now, Sue, how long have you been married for, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, well, here's the story of the year, isn't
it? This sounds like gossip could be coming.
Well, it could be. I hope that's okay. If you're going to announce it, let's do it on a big radio station.
Ooh.
So we were married 22 years.
So you and your husband, Kevin?
Yes, that's right. And we have been divorced 5 years.
Okay.
And then we went to my daughter's graduation last July on my birthday, and it was so lovely to all get together. And then we just went for a drink afterwards and had a coffee and had a chat and cleared the air, because we'd been divorced 5 years.
And you hadn't been in contact that much during
time? No. Now and again for the children, and we always got on very well like that. So here we are in Dubai. And so
you've got back together?
Well, I don't sort of say it like that, really. I prefer to say that it is a new relationship, if you like, a friendship, companionship. He makes me laugh. We go out to lovely places, and so it's a new beginning in a sense.
So what I'm hearing,
I live in my own house, and he lives in his. Which
that's my dream.
No, that is it's the perfect world.
So you're reunited, and it feels so good.
Is there a song coming on?
Sorry. I'll try and find the song for you.
So we'll look around and see what he thinks of me doing that publicly.
He's in the booth. He's smiling. That's good.
If you're going to tell your kids, tell them here.
Wow.
No, my children do know, but it's not that. I don't see it as getting back together and doing all the old things. I actually think it is this new defined thing, and I feel there are no rules. But I think every marriage, I know we're digressing a bit, but every marriage goes through ups, downs, ins and outs, and it's them working through them. But you can get very stuck, and that's what happened. I think you get stuck about the money, you get stuck about the kids, you don't say, shall we go to, you know, a National Trust place or to the cinema.
Lost. And I think it's a very common trap to fall in, and you know, Chastain, we've talked about this in the past in terms of making sure your relationship remains a priority through the kids, because once the kids leave, you've got to think what are you going to have as a couple.
Well, I remember when I was 16, I used to go out with my mum and dad to a club that my mum booked the bands and did stuff. It was attached to the church, and there was a really lovely nurse there who was great friends with my mum and dad, Nuala Gannon. This is a long
time
ago.
That's
a good
Irish name.
A long time ago. But she said to me, Pat is my priority, because she had two girls. And I remember being quite surprised by that. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, the girls will go. They will fly. But Pat and I are very important. Mm-hmm. So they kept their relationship going all the time. And that's easier said than done, isn't it? Because you can get very caught in the socks and pants of life.
Sure. And I think oftentimes there is a lack of awareness that you are changing, that he is changing, and that, you know, once you've gone through the amazing giant distraction of children, you're there with this empty house, and you're different, and he's different. And so I think what you're describing actually is you're dating your husband again and getting to know him, how he is, and he's getting to know you. So there is this, you know, and it's part of the research as well, staying connected to the inner world of your partner, understanding what you're...
And growing. Yeah. That's, and I didn't know, actually, in a sense, that I knew he had a history degree, but we actually love doing things all around history. So we go to art galleries, and we go to... We did the Guy Fawkes Walk on November the 5th, all around London with a group of people. So... It is
it's
interesting.
Like rediscovering that
it
dynamic.
Is. And keeping that energy going and then not taking each other for granted. I think as you get older, you are changing.
Yeah, you think you know them. And you may not, you know, even though you sleep in the same place, you know what they eat for breakfast. But again, there's a big difference between knowing what someone's habits are and what their inner world is. What are the things that they are attracted to, where they find meaning in life? And that has changed. You know, your 60-year-old self is different than your 40-year-old self, than your 20-year-old self.
Very much so.
And so honoring that change.
Well, this is a study that has come out just over the weekend. Headline, couples together for 20 years or more are happier than newlyweds. Chesty, how long have you been married?
10 years.
So you're halfway to happiness.
You could put it that way.
So this is what the research says. Those who, quote, survive 20 years of married life report feeling happier and more compatible than newlyweds. This is published in the journal Social Networks and The Life Course. So researchers from Pennsylvania State University looked at long-term couples that benefited from spending more time in shared activities, as you say, Sue. Who might be kind of relishing each other's company more than the honeymoon period. And this was on 2,034 married people. And they found that marital satisfaction gradually declined during the first 20 years of marriage, but then started to stabilise again after this period. The same trend of decline and increase was true in participation of shared activities. And I think what I think is really interesting is it's such a common trope in sitcoms and films and, you know, and kind of in literature that... happiness declines the older you get in, you know, within that marriage, and that studies officially now show that that's absolutely not the case. So it's not a terminal decline; that is a myth. So,
but we have this culture of everything has to be perfect and everyone has to be happy all the time. And I was speaking to a friend of mine actually on Sunday, who's gone through a breakup after 22 years of being with her partner. And she's now been over a year and she's back up and bouncing again. But she kept blaming herself for not recovering quicker enough. Mm. And I said, but it takes, because I study adolescent psychology, so it takes between 18 months to 2 years to sort of go through any major life change, whether it is, you know, empty nest or whether it is bereavement or it's redundancy or it's a breakup from a long-term partner or a short-term partner, really. And I said to her, you know, you're allowed to be sad. She didn't seem to sort of sit with that. And the idea that you go to the doctor perhaps and we're not allowed to be sad. Again, if you're stuck in that for too long, you need to go and get some help. But talking to people and working your way through the process and seeing it as a process, I think helps people relax a little more about
that. And also, I think it also speaks to expectations of marriage as well.
Yes.
And I remember when I got engaged, my mum sat me down and said, you know, just to let you know, your father and I have had marriage counselling over the years, and you know, if you and your fiance, you know,
that's
soon to be husband, need to get that, then there's absolutely no shame,
different.
and lots of people do. And I'm so grateful that she did say that to me, because I feel like should we need some help in the future, she would be understanding of that. And it's almost like opening up a bit of a door and thinking, my parents who are unspeakably happy, incredibly romantic, being together, you know, 45 years, if they have needed help over the years, then I think everybody should be open to that. Now, when are your children born and what role do you think that might play on their confidence and success? When we come back, we're finding out if being oldest or youngest in class affects their confidence and their odds of entering college. And as Freakonomics say, do summer babies really have a disadvantage? I'm a summer baby. I'm born in July.
And me too.
Oh, are you?
What's your date?
July the 5th.
Oh, I'm the 18th.
Oh, we're still concerned. We can still be friends.
Right, yeah.
It's fine.
And we're not really shy on retiring,
no,
are we?
No, clearly not. But I always felt like being a summer baby, there was a slight disadvantage to this because I was always the youngest in my year. Mm. I always had lovely birthday parties in the UK because we could be outside. Mm. But in terms of academics, I was almost a full year behind some of the eldest kids in my year. Freakonomics, amazing book and went on to be a documentary as well, talked at length about the disadvantage of summer babies, basically saying that if you're the youngest in your year, you may well fail to thrive. So research published, and this was by the Fiscal Studies, showed that children born at the start of the academic year achieve better exam results on average than children born at the end of the academic year. This means children born in the autumn, kind of September, October, tend to outperform those in the summer. A new research published by the IFS, this was recently funded by the Nuffield Foundation, shows that month of birth also matters for other characteristics and outcomes. Now, another study is backing this up, saying being youngest or oldest in class affects kids' confidence and the odds of entering college. And what I find interesting, you know, as adults, age is nothing but a number, but when you're in primary school, you know, those first kind of early years education, a matter of months in terms of milestones can actually make a big difference. A new study finds that students who are considered old for their grade show greater confidence with their studies and are more likely to go to college than the youngest peers in their graduating class. And this was worldwide, and they looked actually in depth in Australia at 10,000 students. And what they found was a 6% advantage over students who were born in kind of a younger month. What's your take on this, guys? Where have you kind of sat yourself, and what about your own kids?
It's challenging in that that's a massive statement.
Isn't it?
That the month you're born in is a predictor for whether or not you go to university. So right away, that sort of strikes a nerve in the sense that what are the variables that they're considering? Yes, you could be looking at college performance, but it's only looking at academic performance first and foremost. Secondly, you could make statements about other sort of issues as well. There's if you're born in winter months, your risk of
vitamin D deficiency,
but of schizophrenia increases ever so slightly. So there's all sorts of risk factors associated. I mean, you can find correlations just about anywhere in life.
And often, if you're looking for that correlation, it can present itself.
What I wrote there is I'm a July baby, and I didn't even know about that. You know, when I was growing up, therefore it didn't affect me supposedly. But is there a danger that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy
and passed down from the parents to the children
as a
result of that?
Oh dear, you know, you're a August baby. However, maturity is different, because I know my son Will was in a different year. He was put up a year, and there was this thing in terms of, I remember as a simple story, but he went swimming with another friend, and because the friend was nearly a year older, his mum left them in the swimming pool and she went to, you know, shopping or something, whereas I was, oh my god, I didn't know you'd left them in this, because Will was almost that year younger, I would have sat and watched them, so to speak. So those sorts of practical things, perhaps. But in a study like that, it is interesting, isn't it?
I think the physical side is an interesting point as well in terms of sports, because Freakonomics did find when they looked at US athletes, especially those in kind of US football, the most common months that they were born were December and January, and that's because those students would have been old for their age, they would have been the physically largest in their group, and they would have been coached and encouraged more by teachers because they would have perhaps seen more potential because they were more physically able because they were that much older. So I think in some places it can be relevant, and this Freakonomic study did actually look when they broke it down, and they were highlighting December, January, that was you know, hard to refute.
Because I also remember talking to Kevin's cousin and their little girl, because both parents were very tall, and the girl was in nursery and she was very tall, and they presumed she was older.
That's a really
And then they
one.
Brought her in, the parents, and said, "No, we're very worried about Caitlin because she's not doing da-da-da-da or something." And it was, and then they looked at the details and went, "Oh, didn't realise she was nearly a year younger than everybody else because she's so tall." So again, it's very, you know, interesting to have studies, and it is interesting to find that balance around things, but then you've got to hold that in sort of the bigger picture too,
of course, and treat our children with their own merits
and individuals.
Exactly. Now, can I ask you what you were like at school, Chastity?
Oh dear, how old?
Let's say high school.
Oh, high school.
You're cringing. I just saw you cringe.
Yeah, look at that body language.
I was a total nerd. Like, so unabashed, unforgiving nerd and proud. Nerds unite.
Yeah. The meek shall inherit the earth.
So, very obedient. And the youngest in my year group, by the way.
Interesting.
It hasn't held you back.
It has not.
And how did you feel about exams?
You know, exams weren't a massive issue for me until I got to uni, I think, in a lot of ways, where it felt like the stakes were much higher. Mm-hmm. And I think in high school, and I think a lot of that has to do with the sort of ethos around the high school, how they accept or tolerate, you know, when you're getting good grades and then maybe you have a little dip, looking at what's going on rather than, you know, you should have studied harder. So I felt like it was a supportive environment where there's wiggle room to allow you to try, allow you to grow, and a safety net there in case you didn't reach the other side of the building.
And how were your parents around exam time? Did you feel like there was pressure on you? Were you putting pressure on yourself, or did it perhaps come from school?
I felt really no pressure from my parents at all when it came to exams and getting good grades. Uni, the pressure came from myself, definitely.
Mm. And what about you, Sue, at school?
Interesting. I've just wrote some notes. I hadn't really thought about it, really. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks this is quite funny. I was quite shy.
Yeah, I do find that funny.
Yes. But I was quite shy growing up. I was bullied at 11 and I got alopecia when I moved to secondary school. I don't quite really, even in hindsight, know why, but I actually think it's why I do the work that I do. I'm so keen on self-esteem. I've written a can-do kid journal for superheroes for kids 7 to 13. All my techniques about self-confidence and being, you know, confident within yourself, not arrogant. I was keen to please my parents. I remember my dad saying when I was younger, they expected me to go to university. So I remember that. But I enjoyed studying in terms of my English. I wanted to be, and I think this is the difference. I actually knew, apparently, from when I was about 5, wanted to be a teacher or a journalist. And hey ho, isn't life funny? Mm-hmm. Teacher for 25 years, now doing this for about 10. And my parents were very supportive. They didn't push me at all. In fact, they had to stop me studying when I was doing my O levels because I seemed to want to keep going and keep going and keep going. So it's a balance, yes. It's an interesting thing.
It's interesting to look back, actually, because when you're in it, you're so in it,
yes.
You know, and you're thinking, I mean, I remember studying, I was the same as you, actually. I really enjoyed studying, and I actually, this is a real confession, I actually quite enjoyed exams.
Like the exams.
I always
I got
did well
nervous.
Under the stress. I don't know why.
Yeah.
And I was completely fine with it.
And has that carried on through your life, that you like the buzz of that pressure?
Yeah, I don't mind a deadline at all. Doesn't really bother me. Yeah. But I never felt much pressure from my parents. The message always seemed to be, as long as you do your best and you can hold your head high. And that was always the niggle. And I was thinking, I really do need to do my best, because if I don't, I have to live with knowing that I didn't.
So you're are we all self-motivated then in that
I don't
sense?
Know. I do need a bit of carrot and stick every so often. Yeah.
There is a little, you know, when I'm right now, I mentioned the research going on at American University in Sharjah, and there's something that happens when I'm sitting down with SPSS. Do you know what SPSS is?
No.
It's statistical software that you use to run the numbers. I get this little like,
buzz.
You know, buzz. Can I say that? I feel like the power of the universe is in my hands, and there are numbers here, and I'm going to turn them into meaning, and it feels incredible. I told you.
You are a nerd.
The nerd is,
well, I didn't like to say.
you can grow up, but the nerd never leaves you. So there is something.
But you know, that language is shocking, isn't it? Because that makes it sound like it's not right. It's wonderful that you find that really interesting, because I'd rather stick needles in my eyes and do the stats. I'm a people person. But we need everybody's part of the jigsaw, and that's why it's fantastic.
Yeah. And when it's come to, trust me, how old are your kids now?
They are 7, 6, and 4. They just had birthdays.
So you have to think about it.
Yeah, that's why it was slower than usual.
Yes. And so your children are in their 20s now?
Yes, my son's 25 and my daughter's 23.
And what was it like being, obviously you're coming from an education background as well, but as a mother, what was it like coaching them and supporting them through their exams. What was your attitude towards studying?
I felt with my own parents, supportive but not pushy. I don't think it helps. There's a lot of talk around pushy parenting, because it implies that if you push, there's resistance. And I wanted them to have a lifelong love of learning. Mm-hmm. And of course I wanted them to do their best, which whatever that means for them. Mm-hmm. I expected them to study. I set it up and with Kevin so that we made it a conducive environment, but we kept it in balance and kept in perspective, so that you do your study, then you'd go and we do something like bowling, or you go and do something fun, not as a reward, just as a break. Mm-hmm. And to keep that, I think that is the important thing. And also when I coach teens, it's about having a goal. You know why you're doing it. That really is a motivator. I knew I wanted to be a teacher. I was working my way, small steps, towards the bigger goal.
And I was exactly the same. I knew from about the age of 13 or 14 what degree I wanted to do at what university, what part-time jobs I would need to do, what A-levels I needed to study, and what results I needed to get. And that's what drove me.
It's your why.
Yeah. And that was my, I mean, I didn't have a plan B. So luckily I got in. Yeah. But as you said, having that goal, but so many people don't have that. And that's what we're going to talk about this afternoon in terms of motivating students to really get into that revision, get into the right mindset, and perhaps parents to apply the right kind of pressure, you know, in being mindful of their own kind of psychological needs as well. Mm. But Chesty, what kind of happens to our brain really when we get into revision and exam mode? Because it's a physically stressful thing on the body.
Sure. So I think before talking about exam mode, it's important to, I guess, give a little primer on stress in general. And so stress, unfortunately, has a bad rap in the sense that it's now associated, and rightly so in some ways, with things like compromised immunity, cardiovascular disease. So there's a lot of ways that stress impacts us in a negative light. But there's also eustress, which is good stress. This is the stress that motivates us to do the things that we want to do. And there's this sort of inverted U shape to stress, where in the right amounts up to a certain point, stress helps kick us from a motivation, from sort of feeling like, I don't really want to do anything, to kicking it into gear, and you know, the papers are getting written, the deadlines are getting met.
You're more focused.
Absolutely. And it's helpful. Yeah. But then there's a point where too much of it becomes, we start getting into psychopathology, things like anxiety, and certainly anxiety's relationship with depression. So when we're looking at stress related to exams, it's important to look at what is performance like. And if we're finding that, you know, when faced with these stressful triggers, that students are freezing, then we need to look at that and try and understand what's going on. Because oftentimes when we unpack it, we're looking at, when we unpack what's going on, you know, when you ask them, what is it that you're really afraid of? It's not doing badly on the test. It's that I'm not going to get into uni. I'm going to end up failing out. My parents aren't going to talk to me, and I'm going to live in a van down by the river.
Massive catastrophizing.
Mm. Yes. And so there's underneath that, you know, very real sort of stressor, which is an exam. You know, exams are not designed, they're designed to test, they're designed to challenge. You know, that's what they're there for.
Earlier on in the show, we were talking about the so-called disadvantage of summer babies. Ella's been in touch on the text line saying, hello, I'm from Poland, where we have children born in January and December in the same class. And it's the year of birth that matters, not the month. School starts in September and ends in June. No one ever wonders or mentions who is younger. The students' performance is very mixed too. It's only when I came to the UK that I came across as youngest versus eldest. I think it's a very big generalisation. It depends a lot on a child's personality, ability, and the parents. Best regards. So, and I think that's an interesting point, actually. It obviously comes down to the merit of the children, but we are seeing trends in terms of people wanting the kind of the kudos of their child being moved up a year, and equally choosing to keep students back as well.
Absolutely. And I think that's a key point to highlight. that you've mentioned, Helen, in this concept of red shirting, which is increasing in popularity.
I've never heard the phrase red shirting before.
Red shirting is essentially you make the decision to hold your child back a year so that they can be the oldest in the year group and therefore sort of emotionally more advanced. And certainly when you're looking at physical, fine and gross motor, cognitive development, there's a bunch of potential advantages to holding that child back. But at the same time, that affects the dynamic of the classroom because you may have children that are 2 years apart. And in the younger grades, wow, particularly when you're looking at FS1, FS2, KG2, it has a big impact on the dynamic of the class. And then, you know, in discussing how this relates, how the birth month relates to academic performance, I think it's also worth noting that they're not necessarily taking into account social emotional. Mm-hmm. And when we're looking at predictors for employment success, emotional intelligence tends to be a better predictor of job performance, job success, than does academic performance.
Ooh, that's a very interesting insight given our topic this afternoon of exam stress. Message here saying, for me, whenever I'm going to appear in exams, my heartbeat increases and I have unnecessary short breaths. And as we said, it can be a very physical manifestation of that stress. People talking about the sweaty palms, feeling cold and clammy, shaky. And I'd be really interested to kind of understand from you both what kind of coping mechanisms or tools you can have to help overcome those physical symptoms. Sue, as your time as an educator and now as a parenting expert, are there any advice you could give to somebody who gets that for those real physical symptoms?
Yes, well, I'm an NLP master and trainer, and I help children visualize success. I get them. I also am an emotional freedom technique practitioner.
What's emotional freedom? I mean, it sounds amazing.
That's tapping. Have you heard of tapping? Yes. That reduces your anxiety. I also talk to children about what is underpinning that anxiety and then give them different sort of strategies for handling, perhaps when they have noticed the triggers and how to then get back into balance. It's all about trying to get it into perspective and get it into balance, and talking and listening to their anxiety, I think, is a good one.
And as Chastity said earlier, trying to really understand where that stress is coming from. It's not just necessarily about the next 2 hours of your life. It's what if I get this grade or I don't get this grade, and what could that ultimately lead to?
Yeah, and that catastrophizing. And remembering that actually you can take your exams again. I did 3 A-levels and everybody expected me to do so well, and I panicked. I remember panicking in the exam. I got very flustered. My heart rate went right up. And I told the story of whatever Shakespeare play I had been studying, it was Antony and Cleopatra, rather than analysing whatever the questions said. And of course, then it's about really reading the question. But anyway, when the exam envelope popped into the, it used to be sent in those days, and it popped into the letterbox, and I opened it, wow, was I shocked not to quite get the grades that I wanted. I was devastated, to be honest. And I remember going to tell my dad, he was shaving. It's what you remember. He was covered in shaving foam. And then, of course, it was wiped off quickly, and support was all around, and people were ringing, and how'd you get on, and all the rest. So in the end, I took another 3 to 6 months, I think, to study again, but learnt the technique of the exam.
That's like learning how to pass the driving test.
And went up to Caxton Hall and did 2 of them again and passed okay, you know, and got the grades I needed.
It's not the be-all end-all, of course, but it can feel like it.
I think that's important, is that what we're finding now, particularly in education, is introducing this gift of failure. If children are able to experience what failure is like earlier on and understand the recovery process, how that helps them cope later on in life is really important. But I also want to mention some fascinating research that's going on related to the stress response, you know, that shaky feeling, that heart racing, that that is, in too much when it's chronic, can have a negative impact on our health. However, our mindset around the stress response is also very important. And so part of it is, may not necessarily, yes, you see them using a lot of mindfulness and breathing exercises to help teens regulate stress anxiety or test anxiety, but just building awareness about what's going on in their body and what that means. And so an example to make it concrete is such that, you know, I'm on my way to the exam. I can feel my heart racing and my hands are getting sweaty. Okay, this is my body telling me I'm about to do something that I'm stressed about. And it's responding. It's trying to, you know, my hands are sweaty because it's preparing me. My heart's racing to help, you know, increase oxygen, to increase blood flow around the body. And so this is my body telling me that I'm going to go into a challenging situation. Just reframing stress from a, I'm freaking out, I'm going to blink, to this is my body's way of coping with an impeding threat or impending threat, way more adaptive. So not, it's not only about the strategies, it's our attitudes and beliefs about stress.
And that actually can start, I talk about the four crucial C's in my work, which is connection, capability and competence, courage, and counting that you're significant and you're important. And actually, if you start young, when the children are young, to make them feel competent and capable, they learn to be more resilient generally in life. So actually, right from the beginning, if you like, you are preparing your children to fail and get back up and handle that in very small ways, so that when you start to grow and go into more challenging situations, you have a sort of a skill set, if you like.
Joined in the studio by a couple of fantastic experts. Sue Atkins is here, UK-based parenting coach, and as we've learnt, former deputy head, so very well equipped to talk about exams and educational stresses. Also joined by Chastity O'Connell. She's a mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Now, guys, I read out a text that came in earlier, and I think this is probably something that a few parents will be able to identify with. Anonymous question saying, my 17-year-old son disappears into his room for hours and he assures me he's revising, but how can I check what he's doing without actually sitting next to him? It's tricky, isn't it?
Because it is tricky.
It's a bit of a trust issue.
It is. And it's a bit of a responsibility issue.
At 17,
His responsibility to want to do well in his exams. Hopefully he's, you know, you know his past. You know whether he has that kind of ethic to work hard or plan. Again, you know, I'm a great advocate of sitting and eating together, not just to nag about eating the broccoli and holding the knife and fork properly when you're little, but actually if you're in your teen's life, simply because they do push you away, let's face it, they want to be independent. But if you're sitting and eating together, you're chatting and you're not checking up. It's all in your tone of voice, it's all in your body language, and it's all in your intention. So if you're supporting, and that intention is to support him, A, not rescue him, or B, judge him, and it is then trusting him that he has got the skill set, and if he needs support, to talk to him about, you know, where can we support you, how can we help you. We can't do the work for you, but like on my website I have some planners, revision planners, so you look at your monthly, you look at your weekly, and you look at your daily planning. So planning is the secret, and I always talk about eat that frog. When I was studying, I used to do the one I didn't like doing and reward myself by then doing the one I quite like later.
That's human nature, isn't it, though? Yeah. I studied endlessly for English and sociology because I was good at them and I enjoyed them. In French, I was like, well,
no. Physics was not my thing.
So I just got massively nationally neglected. May not. There was no frogs. but that is human nature, isn't it? But as you say, in terms of planning, and planning as a family, so as a parent, that you can truly understand what they have to achieve and by when, so you can ask informed questions of them.
Yes, and how's it going? And if they need, because, you know, we're all visual, auditory or kinesthetic learners, so work out how your child, with a mixture of all of those, but if they're predominantly visual, then make posters and post-it notes around the house. Or if they're auditory, you know, create maybe on your phone some auditory stuff that you record it so you can listen to it at night in bed asleep. And if you're kinesthetic, it's doing things that help you learn. So once you've worked out which way your child learns, then you can support them, or they then can support themselves.
Sure. And I would even mention, you know, at 17 years of age, they're at this sort of developmental cusp. And so at this point, it would be worthwhile to look at, what is the outcome? What are the grades that are coming home? What are the marks like? Because if there is, you know, there's pretty good marks, then whatever he's doing is working.
Yes.
And there's a certain element of, you know, I have to let go and let them have the reins at this point in that sense.
Yeah.
Not in everything.
Not in everything.
Michaela messaged in saying, one thing I've learned with four teenagers is that you can't force them to revise. Pushing too much makes them rebel.
Yes. There is that balance, isn't there, between that responsibility and their choice to keep studying. The other way, the thing I learnt with Molly is I learnt and studied in a certain way, and I noticed that Molly didn't. She chewed chewing gum and she listened to music. And I initially kept saying, we have to turn that music off, because whenever I'm writing anything or writing a book or something, I can't have a distraction, or the telly can't be on. But then I realised that she was doing okay in school, so it was working. And so sometimes parents get very pushy and a bit sort of stressed about sort of saying, well, you can't be learning it that way. So actually relax sometimes, as you say, if the grades are okay and over the years the homework's been all right, then actually trust your child to be learning in their own way. You know, they might like making charts and listening to music and chewing gum like Molly did.
But as you said, it's about active revision as well. It's not, we don't learn necessarily just by sitting and reading for hours and hours. It's the highlighting, it's the doing mind maps, yes. You know, drawing the diagrams and really kind
and
of getting
physically
involved.
And sometimes get up physically. I remember doing stuff where I went round the garden in my imagination. I put different facts I had to remember, and then you do it in your mind. It's a bit of fun. And then, of course, when you're in the exam, I remember sitting there going, oh no, I went down the steps and picked that up, information. Then I went over there into the flower pot and picked that up. And it's a silly thing, but it really helped me remember a lot of information at one point.
Now, I want to play you something. So obviously exams are near and teenagers are under a lot of pressure, but have a listen to these open letters by teens to their parents.
Dear Amma and Appa, you know I'm very shy and it has taken a lot of courage to write this letter, so please listen to me.
Exams are near and I'm scared, but not from the exam pressure, but from the pressure from you.
I know I did not do well last time, but believe me, working really hard this time.
You only talk about competition and marks. I feel like I don't have a life anymore.
I have a limited capacity, you know. I can't study continuously for 10 hours in one go.
Sometimes main aap dono se itna dar jaati hoon that I find myself in tears. I feel very suffocated and I just want to get away from it all.
I don't understand why you don't let me meet my friends. I feel trapped.
I know you really care about my studies and get angry at me for not studying. But do you know, I really try hard.
I get tired after studying.
I want to watch football on TV.
You've become a stranger to me. I get a rumbling feeling in my tummy, like I'm going to faint.
You look so stressed during my exams that it makes me nervous.
Appa, why can't we be a normal house?
You always scream and scold me. I haven't slept for nights after getting yelled at by you.
Sometimes it's so frustrating that I feel like locking myself in the bathroom and not talking to anyone.
I know you two really love me and are really concerned about me.
But still sometimes, just let me be.
Those were letters from teenagers to their parents explaining how they're feeling during this exam season. Do we think there's too much pressure on teens at the moment, Sue?
Well, you can hear that. It was rather hard listening to it, wasn't it, I found? It's about eating well. It's about sleeping well.
That's self-care.
And then it's about having fun too. You could hear, oh, you don't let me see my friends. And one of the guys wanted to watch football. You have to have release. You have to have balance. You have to laugh. Don't scold. Support. Encourage. Just hug sometimes. And I think just pause to ponder. I always talk about press your, imagine you've got an imaginary DVD player in your hand. Press your pause button, take a step back and just think, what message are the kids receiving from me in the way I'm acting around their exams? Because I think that's an important thing for a parent to pause to ponder sometimes too.
Message from Stephen saying, I failed my A-levels and swear it hasn't made a bit of difference. I started my own business instead of going to university. I missed out on the social side of being a student, but earn more than all of them now. So it does just go to show. And Ivan messaging saying, my dad in particular put a lot of pressure on me when I was studying and I think it really affected our relationship. I never felt like I could meet his expectations, even when I was happy with my results. I don't have children yet, but would never make that mistake with them. They're more than just a grade. If you've got any questions for our experts this afternoon, we'll certainly try and help in terms of motivating, easing anxiety, and helping with some practical tips for you as parents to help your teens get through this exam season. Now, are there any absolute no-nos about what you should not say to your child during the revision or exam
period? Your sister did better than you.
Oh, that's a stinger.
Or he's the bright one, or you know, you're the clumsy one, or whatever it might be.
But do you feel like those labels do get put on children
very easily?
Oh, yes.
They start very young. Mm. And you have to be mindful. I was actually mindful about that. My son was left-handed, and you know, sometimes he might drop something if he was emptying the dishwasher. So I had to make sure I let him do the dishwasher more, if nothing else, because they, you know, there are expectations, and that those labels can stay with you for a very long time. So be mindful of them, and be careful in your language how you're using those sorts of labels.
But it is easy to be, you know, and I wouldn't hopefully never do this, but yeah, you're the clever one, you're the outgoing one,
you're the sporty one.
Et cetera.
Yeah, and we're doing that. I mean, if you look at sort of the goal of doing that, it's probably coming from a reasonably decent place of trying to motivate someone.
Of course, yes.
But at the same time, this is what is interesting, is what you're using working? If you are nagging and continually fixated on you need to study, and it's not increasing their independent study, independent initiative to study, then what you're doing isn't working. And if we look at a lot of these concepts, you know, if you look at motivation science, motivation theory, you know, you're trying to motivate your child, and maybe you're using external rewards to try and do so.
Is that a bribe? Is that mental health counselor speak for bribe?
If it comes before the behavior is performed, it is a bribe. If it comes after, then it is a reinforcement. But ultimately, I think what people miss is that you are trying to create connections between feeling good about what you're doing. It's kind of like toilet training, for example. You get a sticker or a cookie or a jelly bean if you go to the toilet. But you don't have to do that with your 17-year-old, because ultimately the sensation of going to the bathroom and not having wet pants feels way better than having soiled pants. And so the same sort of principles apply when you're working with teens and trying to promote study habits. And so it really is looking at, is my continually prompting them, is that promoting a sense of independence and giving them autonomy? Is it causing, is it promoting intrinsic motivation towards studying? Or is it the case that basically I am training them to only study when I prompt them to do so?
And then you're just switching them off, actually. I think it's more empowering for parents to ask their kids to, how can I support you or help you in your exams at the moment? And they will tell you, because kids will understand their own pressures. And if you listen to what they say, take a step back from that and go, oh, well, we can do that, we can help with that. Then actually it's a much more empowering question than nagging.
Sure. And it might be that they say, leave me alone.
Yeah, bring me two sandwiches every 2 hours.
Yeah, let me get on with it, maybe.
And so again, zooming out, it's worth the experiment to leave them alone for a little bit and see what happens.
I'm joined by some fantastic guests in the studio this afternoon. UK parenting coach Sue Atkins is here. She's a regular on TV and radio back in the UK. And we've got Chastity O'Connell, one of our faves, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. So do get in touch. Now, I'm just going to read out a letter that went viral in Singapore last year. This is from a principal. And it wasn't directed to the students. This was to the parents. Dear parents, the exams of your children are to start soon. I know you are all really anxious for your child to do well, but please do remember, amongst our students who will be sitting for the exams, there is an artist who doesn't need to understand maths. There is an entrepreneur who doesn't care about history or English literature. There's a musician whose chemistry marks won't matter. There is a sports person for physical fitness is far more important than physics, like schooling. If your child does get top marks, that's great. But if he or she doesn't, please don't take away their self-confidence or dignity from them. Tell them it's okay, it's just an exam. They are cut out for much bigger things in life. Tell them no matter what they score, you love them and will not judge them. Please do this, and when you do, watch your children conquer the world. One exam or a low mark won't take away their dreams and talent. And please do not think that doctors and engineers are the only happy people in the world. With warm regards, the principal. what an amazing educator that man or woman
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Fantastically inspiring.
And I think something that a lot of people do need to be hearing at this time of year. Yes. Do get your questions in if you like, 4001, or use the Dubai Eye Messenger app if you want any advice. Something that can be anonymous. We know obviously sometimes we're talking about sensitive topics here on Dubai Today, so don't feel like you have to put your name on, or you can make up a fake name. We won't mind at all. One message that has come in saying, I'm having the opposite problem as many parents of teenagers. My daughter is so worried about her revision timetable, how much work her friends are doing, stressing about her results and what she'll do if she doesn't get what she needs for university. What can I say to calm her down and reassure her? My immediate thought after reading this message was going, her friends are probably lying about what they're doing and not doing.
We both, we all went like that. I remember Siobhan O'Dowd, I don't know where she is now. She went to Oxford University, though I remember that bit, saying, I haven't done a thing. And I remember I'm working my socks off, and of course I just went, you know, to St Mary's College, Twickenham. But there is that danger, you know, how, you know, girls do hype it all up, and so do boys too. They go on, I'm not doing anything, but they are. And then girls are going, oh, you know, panic, panic, drama, drama. So you have to keep that balance with your kids too, to realise that some people are telling you porcupines, which is lies.
And what about you, Chastity? Any advice on the topic of really what you can say to help reassure a teenager who's in a panic, it sounds like.
I think it depends on where they are in their sort of panic or anxiety experience. If they're just starting, then, you know, looking at things, sort of exploring what the fears are, breathing exercises, mindfulness. A number of schools are doing some mindfulness practices and just breathing exercises and becoming aware of the thoughts and emotions that you have in relationship to what's in front of you can be excellent. And it's, again, it's just the awareness sometimes that, oh, my body is reacting in this way, where, you know, when your heart's racing, we may tend to try and hide that and be embarrassed about it. If it feels like that anxiety is becoming a bit more paralyzing, then it's worth reaching out for some help and support, because you saying, we don't care, you know, we just want you to be happy, if they're already in this sort of anxiety loop, those words may not hit the way that you want them to.
Okay, we're joined on the phone now by David. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon.
Hello, and you've got a 17-year-old son, I understand.
Yeah, so it really started last year just before his GCSE, so he was fine through the mocks. But as he led up to his GCSEs, he started to sort of become nervous at the thought of taking exams. And, you know, you couldn't see the outward panic until he got, I think, just, you know, outside the school before he went for the exams. To the point that then he would, you know, feel like he physically wanted to vomit before he sat down. And for him, unfortunately, the school had to put him in a separate room on several occasions so that he didn't disturb anybody else, because he was so physically, I suppose, wound up with the situation. And then once he got over that and sat down and started to do the exam, he seemed to sort of settle down and things went fine.
So your concern is really what was causing these kind of physical manifestations, and if it's anything more serious that you should be concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, we're a year on now. He thankfully got through his GCSEs, probably not at the results that he had hoped to get, because, you know, he felt a little bit distracted, obviously, with his situation. But now he's halfway through his A-levels, and, you know, they have exams or tests, in-class tests on a regular basis. And again, the anxiety builds up, and he's facing the same situation again.
Sometimes it's very interesting, because it's the school that hype up the anxiety, because they're very mindful, certainly in the UK, about data and getting on these sort of rungs of ladders. And it's not coming from home, it can be coming from school, and that's why home and school need to work together, building sort of bridges rather than barriers, and helping the children manage that stress too. It sounds like they were very compassionate and very helpful, which was rather nice to hear, that they, you know, respected his nerves and put him in another room, perhaps hopefully to support him, not make him feel different and isolated.
How did that make him feel, David? Did he appreciate that space, or did it make him feel set apart physically and emotionally?
I think to a degree it made him feel sort of different to the others. Not mm-hmm. it was done more for the consideration, we believe, of the other students.
Rather than his own well-being.
That's a shame.
Exactly. And of course, he did feel a little bit of an outsider having to sit on his own. But it was both, I suppose, for his benefit as well as the others, because, you know, he couldn't disturb anybody. And I think when he did, you know, sort of get over that anxiety situation, then he settled down and he didn't really bother then after he just got on with the exam.
And now we're thinking about, obviously, is he doing his A-levels next year, would that be?
He's got his AS at the moment, up. And then the A-levels so, next year. But yes,
Trying to think about kind of bolstering him and his confidence and getting prepared.
If there's a way to sort of calm and get something sort of going for him that he can calm down and approach these in a different fashion.
Sure. I think there's a couple of things that might be worth sort of bearing in mind. One is just some psychoeducation around what is the anxiety response, that fight or flight. Because again, I think sometimes what scares students, particularly when they're faced with a stressful situation, is what their body's doing. That, you know, feeling of nausea, that heart racing, sweaty palms, the mind going blank. And these are all part of a sort of natural and healthy and adaptive stress response. At the same time, if it's happening and it's impairing function, then that's when it's time to maybe reach out to a professional to look at some different strategies and techniques. Yeah. But I think what's also helpful is that in this situation, you know, when we talk about anxiety, the biggest defining feature of it is that whatever we're doing is aimed at helping us avoid whatever situation we are fearing. So if there's this intense physical reaction, if there's this nonstop worrying that's cycling through, you know, the brain, the thoughts that are racing, what is it that we're not doing? Well, we're not taking the test. We're not writing the paper that we're supposed to be working on. We're avoiding that which we're afraid of. And in your son's situation, what's amazing is that once he got into the exam, he was able to still complete the exam. And so when you're looking at trying to help children with test anxiety, it's exposing them to that threat and helping them learn a new association where, oh, here goes my tummy. I feel like I'm going to throw up. And that happens, and I think it's also sometimes adding a little bit of humor to it as well. And sort of one of my favorite things that I think a lot of people don't know about is what stress does to that intense stress to your digestive tract, the vomiting, and the stress poops. Those are two things that can go hand in hand with test anxiety.
And sometimes the figure of eight, you know, when you go round in those, that whole thing goes round and round and round. And to break that state is an important thing. So is it jump up and down, or is it to listen to music? Or it's usually taking action of some sort, because when you're going in the figure of eight over and over again, that tends to help. The other thing I'd really like to ask you is, what did he learn from the experience to empower himself?
Because we used to talk to him about it afterwards, and my wife obviously was with him more often because she took him to the exams and then brought him home afterwards. And he actually said he didn't know why he was feeling that way, because he did his revision. He has great grades during the year. His work is, you know, the top of the class during the year. It's just getting to that point of taking the exam and I mean, really, he hasn't changed much since then. Still, first year of A-levels, the work is great. But he's now, you can see it coming back, because he's facing a few exams to come up now, and you can see the nerves coming back and the concern that he has these exams around the corner. It does affect
him. Yes, so help him break the pattern, because what he's got is an anchor, and he thinks exams equals stress, anxiety, tummy ache and all the sickness. Yep. So you've got to break that anchor, and I wish him very well.
Thank you, David. Really appreciate it. Do let us know, keep us updated on how he gets on. Message here saying, hi, it sounds like he has a fear of failing. And so you're just saying then that actually being a perfectionist can be very, very challenging in those situations.
Yes, it can, because I'm one of those. I'm a recovering perfectionist. And it's actually the lowest standard you can have, because you can never achieve perfection. So you need to learn to handle that and be forgiving of yourself. And, you know, you're good enough is good enough.
But that's a very mature outlook. And I think it takes a lot of people a lot of time to really accept who they are and have that kind of love it for themselves.
And that's why parenting is so important. And we start from a very early age to build that resilience and that idea that it's okay to make mistakes. I always say and said to my kids, but what did you learn from that experience? And right from the get-go, that's the mindset that we all make mistakes, but it's about getting back up again. And perhaps the definition of madness is to keep doing the same thing over and again and expecting a different result. But get into that mindset of then empowering your child that mistakes are okay, because when you start to learn, I don't know, football or ballet or whatever you're learning, to play hockey or something, you're never going to just be an expert at that and be really great. It is in the mistakes that you make that you go, well, actually, I need to, oh yeah, next time I'm going to do that. And so that takes away that pressure on a child to be perfect.
Adnan was on the text message 4001 to have your say or ask any questions. He asked, do you think parents should be doing tests at home from an early age to normalise exams? My children are 6 and 8.
Ready? No.
So that's a no, ladies?
Well, here's the thing. When we're talking about testing as a tool for learning, testing is actually amazing as a tool for learning, but it's what we do with those results.
Yeah,
and I think it's hard, because on one hand, we know that when you sit down and you're studying for an exam, you start flipping through the book and you go, oh yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know that. I know that. And then you get to the exam and you are faced with questions and you see those questions and you're like, oh, I remember. What was that? And so you really struggle with recall. So testing yourself is a really effective way to understand, do you know what you think you know? And so self-testing can actually be really helpful. But the problem is, what is done with those results? What is done with that information? How does that get used by the school, by parents who say, oh, my child got a 10 out of 10 on that one? And again, it's sort of like, what do you do with it, and who is it going to be helpful?
Yeah, because when I used to teach as well, there were children that would get 8 out of 10 in their spelling test and go, oh my God, that was awful. And I said, but you got 8 right. Oh, I hadn't thought of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you've also got to educate parents in how they analyse what those things are. And again, you know, it's all about getting a balance in that. But most people go, oh no, it's what I don't know, and they panic about mm-hmm. that. They rarely celebrate what they do know. So you have to, again, get into that mindset. I'm a great believer in everything happens early on in life, so that you then come up to this stage in your life already kind of empowered with mm-hmm. some suggestions around how to handle stuff.
Or at least having a familiarity with what it means to experience disappointment.
Yes.
Because when we're, especially mm. with the father that called in very compassionately about his son, and I think another individual texted in, there's a fear of failing. Mm. If it is possible now that you know, with children, you have them being teenagers and not really having experienced a deeply upsetting event
or step back.
Yeah, experiencing those emotions, maybe in infancy when, you know, someone didn't come quick enough to change their diaper, but, you know, this idea when a child gets hurt, parents swooping in to try and comfort. When a child doesn't make the team, swooping in, okay, well, I'm going to take you to bounce. I'm going to take you here. I'm going to try and make the pain go away. Again, all well-meaning, but you're also denying your child the opportunity of sitting with some very natural, healthy, and painful emotions.
Yes.
And pain is inherent in the human experience. All of us here, we all experience pain. Suffering is when we try and avoid that pain, when we try and distract ourselves away from the pain. And so what you end up getting is the situation where you have very capable, very intelligent, very well-adjusted individuals who are deeply afraid of this painful emotion of failure or painful emotion of loneliness. Loneliness is another big one that comes up a lot with teens.
I wrote an article actually called Failing Forward, because it's that idea that you fail, but then it's what you do with it, and then it leads you to the next step. But you're absolutely right. This idea of protecting children from never making a mistake or never failing is actually doing them a disservice.
It doesn't serve them at all. A comment here saying, far too much pressure is put on kids these days. Let's not forget they're taking exams in their teens, and that generation will be living easily into their 90s and will probably do numerous jobs, most of which haven't even been invented yet.
Absolutely.
Yes, that is true.
We can all go home now.
Perspective there. Yes. Thank you, whoever sent that in. So true, though, isn't it? You know, we are living in different times now where you wouldn't graduate university and, you know, work as an accountant from the age of 20 to, you know, 60. And giving thumbs up to your accountant husband. But now, you know, people swap between careers much more easily.
Yes.
And that could be changing careers in their 40s or having more pick and mix approach to having a portfolio of careers that exist at the same time. It's times have moved on quite considerably in that sense. A question here on the practical front I'm hoping you can help with. I'm a working parent and can't be around in the afternoons to enforce studying. I wish schools offered more study support in the afternoon so I'm not spending my day wondering if she's watching cat videos and lying to our helper or actually doing work. But I think that's a fair point in terms of, you know, working parents and schools do finish, you know, kind of at earlier times here, certainly a good few hours before office hours as well. Any advice there on trying to kind of motivate and make sure that work is happening when parents are not in the home?
I think one of the things that you could think about is, and this is where it can be very child-led, where they write a list of what they worked on and what they completed. And it's there for mom or dad to take a peek through when they get home. And that helps the child prioritize the things, depending on the age, of course. And maybe mom or dad can also create a list. Reasonable, measurable, and aimed at, I want, you know, if you keep in the back of your mind, I want my children to be excited about learning, then that's going to shift how you structure, how you help them, how you help them structure how they allocate their time, how they direct their interests, and all of that matters when you're looking at intrinsically motivated learners. And that's ultimately what you're trying to go for, or what you're trying to implement or instill in your children.
Maybe you can help with this one. No name on this one. Asking, what can I say to my son who works hard, his teachers agree, but just isn't getting the marks? I want to motivate him, but I'm confused and disappointed.
Well, the other thing you have to actually be realistic about here is your expectations for your son is, you know, are they able to? I mean, it wouldn't have been sensible for me to have been studying physics because I just wasn't able to cope with some of the maths and didn't understand it, not that I was particularly interested in it either. But you have to have a realistic, and this is going to be a difficult thing to sort of say, is your child, you know, able? Your expectations might be too high. Also, we haven't spoken at all around children with special needs or additional needs, and I'm not for any minute saying that your child has that, but we have to have different expectations around children that struggle. Say they've got dyslexia, they need longer to learn, they need a different way to study the subjects as well. The way you're expecting them to do things is perhaps not the way they feel comfortable with. So that's a whole thing to actually pause to ponder. Not everyone can be top of the class.
Sure.
No, of course not. And also there might be subjects that, you know, his skills lend themselves well to and others that simply don't. And that's, I think everybody has experienced
that. You know, there's another thing that I remember reading and talking about, the idea that you're pushing your child to study French when they really don't like it and they'll never use it again. But yet, how about encouraging them to do something that they really do like and that they'll be using in their bigger picture life? So you have to sort of weigh that up. Otherwise, you're wasting a lot of time learning French when you could be excelling perhaps in, I don't know, something else.
It must be frustrating, though, to see your child really working hard and really pushing themselves and not getting the results that he or she or you want. I think that actually does speak to your earlier point about people learning, revising and excelling in different ways of studying.
Absolutely.
And then realising that, you know, the bigger picture is you never know when your child may find what they're good at or they love or that they really enjoy. They could be in their 20s, 30s or, you know, in your midlife when you finally find your niche of, oh, this makes sense with what I want to do.
Question here from Aisha, saying, I'm naturally bright and academic, as is my husband, so I find it frustrating that our daughter just isn't interested in schoolwork at all. Any advice for finding common ground and phrases I can use or say to get her to understand how important studying is, especially in this economic climate?
I'm first curious as to how old the child is.
That's what I was going to wonder.
So I think that's important to understand what age we're working with. And I think, to be honest, my answer sort of depends on if we're looking at younger, at littles, at trying to get them engaged in schoolwork, or are we talking about teenagers? Because chances are with children, there's things that they're interested in. And so starting with where their interests are. So basically meeting them where they're at.
Yes.
And so if your daughter's not interested in school, but she's interested in going to bounce or I love trampoline parks.
Trampoline twice.
Yes, I'm trying not to. All of my analogies involve trampoline parks.
But it could be, gardening, or, it could be gaming or anything.
Well, and you can take something like a trampoline park and turn it into a geometry problem. You can also look at, so that's, how do you convert abstract problems in a textbook to practical
it's
life
making it
problems.
Meaningful,
yes,
actually.
Absolutely.
And also, it's a very general term, she doesn't like school. I would be asking more questions as in, which bit don't you like?
Yeah,
is it PE? Is it maths? Is it something else?
Or is there something bigger?
Is it
the social side or bullying?
Absolutely. What bit of school don't you like? And then work from there. Mm-hmm. And again, take some pressure off, because children feel anxious, and certainly if they get into teenagers, they will definitely just go the opposite of what you want them to do.
Yeah.
Question that's just come in, saying, my daughter is 13 years old. She's intelligent but doesn't like school, finds it boring, and does the minimum in regards to studying or homework. I don't really care about her scores, but more worried that she won't have the drive and motivation to reach her potential, especially as an adult. Should I be worried, and what can I do?
I'd be looking at her interests as well. Perhaps she's more entrepreneurial, because sitting there sometimes listening to certain things, you can't see the relevance of them. And certainly there's a whole band of kids that are going to be very entrepreneurial in life, because it's a different way of thinking about things. So again, look at that and talk with her and find out.
Mm-hmm. Justy, anything on this latest text?
What I find interesting and worthy of a little shout out is the fact that she finds school boring and is still managing to get the work done. I mean, if we think about our own day-to-day lives as adults, how many things we do not want to do and we put off and we put off and we put off.
Constantly.
Yes, washing and ironing.
Yes.
My absolutely filthy car that my husband's bugging me about twice daily.
And so I think there is, you mentioned the fears about motivation. There's motivation there, because if she's getting it done, even though it's not in the amount that you might hope for, she's somehow harnessing, which I think is something to, something to be acknowledged, that she's harnessing the motivation to get the work done. And maybe looking at, what is it that helps you get something done that you don't even like doing, and understanding that.
Just want to give a little bit of perspective when it comes to exam season. There's some very famous and, let's be brutally honest, very rich people out there who have had a whole lot of success without really getting those grades. Jeremy Clarkson's not someone that I hold up as a huge example in life, but I do appreciate this. The broadcaster, journalist and writer lifts the spirits of teens almost every year with the fact that he left school with a C and two U's. Let me read you a few of his tweets. 2014, he says, if your A-level results aren't joyous, take comfort from the fact I got a C and two U's and I have a Mercedes-Benz. In 2015, he tweeted, if your A-level results aren't great, be cheered by the fact that I got a C and two U's and I'm currently sitting in a villa in Saint-Tropez. And 2016, he tweeted on exam results day, if your A-level results are disappointing, don't worry. I got a C and two U's and I'm currently on a super yacht in the Med. So I'm wondering where he's going to be this summer and where he's going to be tweeting from. But it is a worthy reminder that they're not the be-all and end-all, especially if you're not looking to go into something super academic. Obviously, actors and musicians don't necessarily need those traditional grades. Benedict Cumberbatch says, I did sort of blow my GCSEs. I couldn't believe it, and neither could my teachers. and there was a lot of pressure for me to achieve an Oxbridge level of brilliance at A-level. But then adolescence came and I discovered girls and all sorts of other things, so I got a bit lazy. That stagnated my growth as far as being an academic. Sir Alan Sugar left school with one GCSE and is now worth $1.4 billion. And Jon Snow, for any fans of the UK broadcaster and journalist, he only got one A-level, it was a C in English, and he's one of the most successful TV journalists on TV. So, just goes to show, but I want to give final words now to a message that came in from Joseph. And I think this is actually something that really makes a lot of sense. Joseph says, teenagers have enough pressure on them. The main message I want to get across to my three teenagers is that we love them whatever, that it matters to try their best, but that exams aren't the be-all and end-all. My wife and I have been chatting with them a lot about family and friends, and they know who are a complete mixed bag in terms of school successes. Any final words, parenting coach Sue Atkins, any parents who are in the trough of exam stress at the moment?
Keep it all in balance and keep your sense of perspective. And I always say a smile is a curve that puts a lot of things straight.
And Chastity O'Connell.
C's get degrees. That's it. They do. And, you know, I just, C's get degrees. And the reality is the way that the pace of change in the world today, the content that we know is not nearly as important as how flexible and adaptable yes. we can be.
So emphasizing the emotional intelligence as much as those grades yes. to help those kids go far.
Yes.
Thank you both for joining me this afternoon. It's been an absolute pleasure and I really appreciate your insights.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.